Also schönen guten Abend. Es ist mir eine große Freude, heute Abend Dr. Vaso Ayero vorzustellen als einen wirklich hervorragenden Wissenschaftler, Anthropologen und Kulturkritiker, aber auch als einen Freund, den ich seit 12 Jahren gut kenne aus Zypern. Vassos was born in the little village of Konya in Cyprus and grew up in the working class neighborhood of Kaimakli in the Cypriot capital Nicosia. He received his master in social anthropology at the London School of Economics and his PhD at Indiana University in the United States with an ethnographic study on Cypriot modernity, and some here in the room have been confronted with his book quite early in their studies. It's published under the title Traditional Modernity in the Mediterranean, The Wedding, a Symbolic Struggle, and it's a critical analysis of modernization processes in Cyprus, but also I think it stands for a new ethnographic mode in tackling the Mediterranean. Taking a classical anthropological topic, namely wedding rituals, as its focus, Vassos dissects symbolic practices where claims for modernity in the sense of Western attitudes and practices embraced by the Greek Cypriot urban middle class are juxtaposed to traditional practices as an expression of rural populations and working class resistance against bourgeois values. With often scathing criticism, he addresses issues of power, domination, and inequality that underlie both the anthropological constructions of tradition and modernity and the ways in which social actors appropriate these concepts. As Vassos argues, modernization should not be understood as a secular, progressive process of social, economic, and cultural improvement. Rather, modernization should be analyzed as a legitimizing discourse in which Cypriots represent and contest relationships among social classes between old and young men and women, city folk and villagers. In this book, he already tackles what can be called the coloniality of modernization in Cyprus, and as he argues, by invoking the discourse of modernization, Cypriots are submitting to foreign cultural standards and partly colonial standards and are accepting the symbolic domination of Europe. His ethnography was supervised by Michael Hertzfeld, who will also deliver a lecture later in the series. After teaching at Intercollege in Nicosia and several universities in the US, Dr. Ayero is now senior lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Hull in Great Britain. Interestingly, Talal Asad published his renowned book Anthropology and the Colonial Encounter in 1973 while teaching anthropology in Hull. And Vassos, in his work and research interests, is true to this spirit of the place. At the moment, Dr. Ayero is a visiting professor at the University of Cyprus. His publications engage philosophy and intellectual history, theorizing the anthropological enterprise in novel ways that deepen and substantiate the sometimes, as I think, airy post-colonial critique which are put forward by other authors. This is especially apparent in two other books he has published in recent years. In his second book, Anthropology and the Will to Meaning, a Postcolonial Critique, published in 2002, he expands the theoretical apparatus developed in his first book and applies it to a thought-provoking, sometimes even provocative, but always extremely stimulating, analysis of the production of difference and alterity in anthropology. His most recent book, titled The Logic of Environmentalism, Anthropology, Ecology and Postcoloniality, published in 2005 with Berkham in London, analyzes the cultural construction of ecology and ecological thinking. In his analysis, he picks up an earlier research concern originally developed in fieldwork on popular attitudes to environmentalism in Greek Cypriot society. Exploring the problems that environmentalism faces when it explains its own emergence simply as a response to the ecological crisis and neglecting that it is a truly modernist project, this work builds on significant new research and discussions, mostly from Anglo-American social science discourse, but also engaging continental European philosophy as well as non-Western post-colonial scholarship. So I'm really delighted that he agreed to come to Berlin to present his talk under the title, and here it is, Post-Coloniality, Living with the Idea of Europe in Cyprus. So, sorry, I'm not.
Supposed to take this
stand
over there.
Is it okay for you, or do you want to sit?
I
don't
know.
Can
also
rearrange
the technical.
Just take this over,
man.
Whatever.
But okay. I think actually, can you see?
No, I will stand.
Okay. Here.
Yeah. Well, thanks for inviting me to come here. It's an honor that you have invited me. It's a very interesting thing that you started off with my dissertation, which became a book on traditional modernity in the Mediterranean. And sometimes when I think about my work, I always think that I'm still trying to solve the problems that I posed in that book. And I haven't yet. And I don't know whether I will ever be able to solve the problems that I posed in that book. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, certain things stay with you and they pester you throughout your life. So at least this is my case anyway. I have a text here and I'm going to read it partly. I'm just going to try not to make it too boring for you. I usually talk from notes, but was it something I said? I usually talk from notes, but I'm going to talk about some ideas which I have been trying to develop for quite some time now. In fact, to be honest, for the last 5 years, and I've been going round and round in circles. I think I got the hang of it now, pretty much. But not quite. So some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about today are these things that I've been trying to develop, and what I'm trying to say is that they are very slippery in many ways, so I may lose it. And I thought to myself that the best thing to do is to read rather than just talk and improvise, just in case I lose the train of my thought, as it were. And therefore, some of the things also that I'm going to talk about go back to my early work on the traditional modernity in the Mediterranean. And in fact, traditional modernity are two things that I'm still struggling with in many ways. The title of the presentation is Postcoloniality, Living with the Idea of Europe in Cyprus. And after I sent the title, I thought about it and I thought, maybe that's the wrong title. I should have said something slightly different as a title. And I'm just going to explain what I should have said. I should have said living with the specter or the phantom of Europe in Cyprus. And the reasons that I have for using these two terms, specter or phantom, is twofold. First of all, phantoms or specters are known to cause nightmares. I mean, they cause nightmares to me anyway. But thinking about Cyprus, they cause nationalist nightmares. And the idea of Europe caused, I think, national nightmares in Cyprus. The second reason that I have for saying that Europe is a phantom or a specter is because, as we know, specters lead a double life in the sense that they exist and at the same time they don't exist. They exist because we can imagine them, but they don't exist because they are not empirical. They are not part of empirical reality. I think that the idea of Europe, or at least the most fundamental premise that has been used to distinguish Europe from non-Europe, is a phantom in that sense. It exists only as a figment of the imagination. And this premise, this fandom premise that I had in mind, is the Enlightenment directive: think for yourself. And of course, think for yourself if you want to be yourself. In other words, if you want to be an autonomous subjectivity. I think this is a specter or a phantom and a figment of the imagination. I will try and explain as I go along. So what I want to talk about largely is this idea, the possibility of autonomy or independence, if you like, not so much the autonomy of individuals, but the independence of societies or nation states, for example, and especially the independence of countries from colonial rule. And the state, the nation state that I want to talk about, of course, is Cyprus, which this year celebrated 50 years of independence from British colonial rule, or at least part of the country celebrated the 50 years. So as you can see, colonialism is not restricted to faraway places, exotic places in quotes. It was around the corner, certainly in the Mediterranean. Cyprus is one example, and of course Malta is the other example of a colonized society. This celebration of the 50 years of Cypriot independence was also the initial reason why I wrote this paper initially, or a version of this paper initially, for a local academic journal that decided to bring out a special issue to celebrate the 50 years of Cypriot independence. I also thought that it may be a good idea to give a brief historical outline in case people don't know much about Cyprus or not at all. When I was in the States once, I wanted to send some money to Cyprus, and I called the bank and I said, I want to send some money to Cyprus. The guy said, Cyprus, California. Uh-huh. I said, no, Cyprus, Cyprus. So, you know, Cyprus is a tiny little place, so a lot of people don't know anything about it, and that's fine. So just a few things about it. Historical, just to give you historical background, basically, this is what I mean. It was an Ottoman province to begin with in its recent history, before the British came in 1878. Before the Ottomans, it was ruled by the Venetians, it was ruled by the Franks, by the Byzantines, and so on to ancient times, when, as the Greek Cypriots at least point out, the mainland Greeks came over and Hellenized the indigenous population. And since then, it has always been Greek. This is what the Greek Cypriot nationalists say, that it has always been Greek. Now, the British leased the island. It was a question of renting, you know, like you rent a house, as it were. They didn't get it as a colony. They leased the island from the Sultan, and they annexed the island formally to the crown as a colony in 1925. I think the reason was to punish the Turks for siding with the Germans in the First World War. So you guys are going to pay now for siding with the Germans in the First World War, so we're going to take it, we're not going to pay you any rent anymore, and it's going to be a colony. So that's what happened. In 1955, Greek Cypriots began an armed struggle against the British, whose aim was to unify Cyprus with Greece, a name, of course, which the Turkish Cypriots and Turkey didn't share. The compromise of this struggle was independence, whose 50 years Greek Cypriots celebrated this year. And I say Greek Cypriots because the Turkish Cypriots do not celebrate the Cypriot independence. Instead, they celebrate their own independence from Greek Cypriots in the form of the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which is an entity recognized only by Turkey, at least for the time being. Who knows what's going to happen in the future. So there are two Cypruses, as it were. The Greek Cypriots will not like me that I say this, that there are two Cyprus. They insist that there is only one Cyprus. But the reality is like this. There are two Cyprus is one in the south, which is the Republic. It's Greek, it's internationally recognized, and it's a member of the European Union. And the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus in the north, which is Turkish, and as I say, it is not internationally recognized yet. Now, this division was, in its present form at least, was established in 1974. Very quickly, I'm not going to bore you with historical details. At the time, there was a military coup by Greek Cypriots who overthrew the government, and the aim was to unify Cyprus with Greece. It's a plan that didn't work out in the end, because in the meantime, Turkey invaded Cyprus and split it into two. The Greek Cypriots living in the north moved to the south. The Turkish Cypriots in the south were allowed to move to the north. In 2003, the Turks in the north opened several checkpoints on the so-called Green Line, which Greek Cypriots like to compare with the Berlin Wall. Particularly in Nicosians, where I come from, they say, you know, we have the last wall in Europe. That's the Green Line. So now, since 2003, it's possible for people to cross over. You know, Greek Cypriots can cross to the north, and Turkish Cypriots can come to the south as well. In 2004, there was a United Nations plan for the reunification of the country, and it was put to the vote in both communities. The Greek Cypriots, being what they are, I'm one of them, by the way, overwhelmingly rejected it. The Turkish Cypriots overwhelmingly accepted it. A few months later, Cyprus, or the Republic, became a member of the European Union. So this is very briefly the history of the country. And I want to turn now from history to theory and what I call the colonized mind, which is a term that I borrow from the Komarovs. And I think the Komarovs are coming to give a lecture here as well. Good. I don't know them personally, I just know their work. And I use this term because I'm using this term about the colonized mind. I use it slightly different, in a slightly different way. In a nutshell, the Komarovs, are optimistic about the possibility of the decolonization of the mind, and they see the struggle for independence as a first step towards this direction. I, on the other hand, being a pessimist by nature, I'm not so optimistic, and I see the struggle for independence, in fact, as a manifestation of the colonized mind. So, the colonized mind. I will start with a reference to a very well-known book on subjection by the well-known feminist Judith Butler, feminist scholar Judith Butler, and she begins the discussion of this idea on subjection, talking about power, by making a distinction. He distinguishes between two different kinds of power. She points out, we understand power as something outside of us, exerting pressure on us and preventing us from doing things that we want to do, or forcing us to do things that we don't want to do. And that's one conception of power, of course. It is the common sense experience, I think, of power. It is also the liberal conception of power. And it is real enough. I mean, nobody's saying that this is not a real thing. It's something that we all experience in our lives. But her point is that beyond this kind of power, or rather this kind of power doesn't exhaust what power is or what it does. And she follows Foucault in this to explain the second kind of power. And she says that if we were to follow Foucault, one has to acknowledge the existence of another form of power and another function, and namely, as that which, and this is a quotation, as that which is forming the subject as well, providing the very conditions of his existence and trajectory of its desire. End of the quote. Now, I think that the consequences of this understanding of power, if we are going to take it seriously, and if we do believe that it has a basis in reality, I think there are far-reaching consequences. I think that Butler herself is not prepared to accept the consequences of what she says, at least not as the final word on the matter. Now, what are these consequences? Well, if it is power that forms the subject, if there is no subject without power, anything that the subject does, including resisting power, is bound to reproduce it. And Butler recognizes this, and she recognizes that this is a vicious circle. If we resist power, we end up reproducing it, and she calls it a vicious circle. And in fact, she is using this very interesting term to explain the predicament of the dominated in contemporary society. She says we live in post-liberatory times, which I take to be times beyond liberation. So she's prepared to accept that there is a circle, but she's still struggling to find an exit. And I think Foucault also was trying to find an exit himself. Until the end of his life, he was trying to do so. In my view, there isn't an exit. And I think this is what makes largely the idea of Europe a phantom, a specter, or a figment of the imagination, if you like. Now, Butler's choice of Foucault as the leading authority on the question of power is, of course, understandable. He said so many things about it. But I think it's very important to bear in mind that this argument about power, if not the medium through which it is expressed, is hardly new. It's not new, let alone postmodern. It's an old argument as far as I'm concerned. I think it's an old argument. I think the idea that the subject is formed, that it is a product of historical, social, and cultural conditions, I think is a fundamental sociological premise whose development can be traced from Marx to Durkheim to Mannheim to Bourdieu, just to mention a few of the key figures involved in this understanding. Now, related to this idea is the equally fundamental question of the liberation of the subject from social conditioning, which is supposed to be achieved through what Bourdieu calls socioanalysis, as in psychoanalysis, but socioanalysis, not psychoanalysis. In other words, by making conscious the unconscious in history, society, and culture, thereby bringing motivation and action under rational control. I beg your pardon, I have to blow my nose. I'm allergic to something. I don't know what it is. Sorry, this has been going on for quite some time. I don't have a cold, it's some sort of allergy. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Okay, so this is the idea that you're just trying to make the unconscious conscious, and if you make it conscious, you can bring it under control, the same way that if you are neurotic, you go to psychologists, psychiatrists, they find out what is repressed, you bring it to your conscious, and you are relieved, and you are fine. It doesn't work like that, of course, but that's the theory anyway. Now, of all the theories that I've just mentioned, Mannheim was probably the least optimistic about the possibility of making the historical or social or cultural unconscious conscious. He thought that everybody is socially, culturally, and culturally situated, that no one is free-floating, except, he thought, at some point, intellectuals. His idea was that maybe the intellectuals are a bit detached and they can see things objectively and so on. I think today we know better. We know that intellectuals are human beings too. So, I mean, I think Mannheim knew it as well, but he was desperate trying to get out of the circle. Another thing that I need to mention in relation to this idea of making society and history transparent, this idea forms the basis of the sociological distinction, not the anthropological distinction. I don't know if any anthropologists would take up this point of view, but certainly a lot of sociologists would argue this point. And it's the distinction between the modern and the traditional, Europe and non-Europe. I said I was going to come back to the modern and the traditional. So the modern and the traditional, Europe and non-Europe, in effect, what we mean or what sociologists mean by this, the difference between supposedly reflexive, rational, and free societies and those in which the social is experienced as immutable nature, as a nature which cannot be changed. Now, this distinction is not old, it's new. We heard it very recently by the likes of people like Anthony Giddens and Ulrich Beck, the so-called theorist of reflexive modernization. Now, Jeffrey Alexander, another American sociologist, who doesn't like them very much, and I don't like them very much, I have to say, he wrote a critique of their work, and he says that Giddens and Beck turned Foucault on his head and the pathologies of modernity into virtues. Now, I think that the problem is even more fundamental than that. I think this idea of reflexivity is a figment of the imagination, and so is also the presumed autonomy that follows from this idea. Now, if this is the case, as I think it is, at least, the distinction is untenable. The modern is, in this sense, the same as the traditional. Reflexivity is the same as the lack of it. Autonomy is the same as consent. Now, these are the slippery ideas I was talking about. So I had to read them out very carefully. But now, to return to the implications of this way of thinking vis-a-vis the ex-colonies and their presumed independence, it should be apparent that the conventional political discourse, and I say political in the narrow sense of the term, which equates independence with the end of colonial rule, operates with the common sense liberal conception of power. And of course, there is another much broader sense of the political, what is often called the politics of culture or identity, and another story to be told about power, namely as that which colonizes the mind and rules the subject from within. Talal Asad points out, as he points out, rather, this story, and this is a quotation from Talal Asad, tells of European imperial dominance not as a temporary repression of subject populations, but as an irrevocable process of transmutation in which the old desires and ways of life were destroyed and new ones took their place. End of quote. In other words, it tells of the post-colonial condition and present us with a paradox in which apparently independent, self-determining nation states conform freely to to the dictates of the ideologies of the metropolitan powers. Now, if this story can be told at all, it is precisely because power can be conceptualized as that which forms subject as a way of life that generates specific desires and accounts for specific actions. And if this story were to be told from the beginning, one would have to start with the most fundamental manifestation of European power and the most burning desire that this power generated in the colonies. This is none other than the desire to become modern, like European societies, which meant, first and foremost, nation states in their own rights. One is tempted to say, says Žižek, the Slovenian critic, and this is a quotation, he says, one is tempted to say in his discussion of the modality of this, the modality of power, one is tempted to say that the will to gain political independence from the colonizer in the guise of a new independent nation state is the ultimate proof that the colonized ethnic group is thoroughly integrated into the ideological universe of the colonizer. End of quote. I find the expression that he uses to begin with, one is tempted to say, he's saying it, but he said, one is tempted to say this thing, which is to say it and not to say it in a certain sense. And I think there is a good reason for it. One is tempted to say it, but it is best not to say it, or at least not to say it as the last word on the matter. Because as I've just suggested, the wider implications are far-reaching. If one says this and if one believes in this, then the implications are far-reaching. Reflexivity and autonomy, which I think are the most fundamental myths of the last 200 years, would not be able to bear the burden of such an admission. In the immediate context, the context that we're discussing, if one dares to say it, nationalism becomes the mark of a fundamental complicity with the colonizers, with their mode of thought and way of being in the world. Now, this tacit, implicit recognition of the colonizer as the source of all legitimate signification about what it means to be, it's a question of ontology here, what does it mean to be a person, an ethnic community, a society? This is not always apparent in the colonies. In fact, it is very often lost in the politics of independence, nowhere more so than at the moment of maneuver. This is a term that I used from an Indian scholar, Chatterjee, and he calls the moment of maneuver the time of the anti-colonial struggle. At this time, of the anti-colonial struggle, there has to be a critique of European modernity. It becomes absolutely necessary because you need to mobilize people for the struggle. Now, Chatterjee uses the case of Gandhi to illustrate this point. As is well known, Gandhi produced a sweeping critique of European modernity, but there was one thing that he could not reject, one European idea that he could not reject, and that was the idea that the only way to be an ethnic community was in the form of an independent nation state. Without taking on board this modernist assumption, he would have no grounds to struggle against the British colonial rule and to call for an independence. And because he did take this assumption on board, he ended up slipping into modernist thinking more and more. And Chatterjee comments on this He says that when Gandhism was forced to deal with practical organizational issues of what was, after all, a bourgeois political movement, and this is a quotation, it would argue in terms of categories such as capitalism, socialism, law, citizenship, private property, individual rights, and he would struggle to fit this, his formless. Sorry, I can't talk tonight. What's wrong with me?
I'm just using formless.
I
see formless.
Sorry, I'm going to repeat this. It would argue in terms of categories such as capitalism, socialism, law, citizenship, private property, individual rights, and struggle to fit its formless utopia into the conceptual grid of post-Enlightenment social scientific thought. He started with this idea and he went down the road. Of course, he didn't, because he didn't live long enough to go down the road. But Nehru and Nehru was a modernist anyway. Now, no doubt the case of Gandhi is a limited case, but it is no less instructive for this reason. To paraphrase Bourdieu, who raises this issue of complicity in another context, because he says, it's a paraphrase, it's not a quotation, because he says the opponents agree sufficiently on the stakes to fight for them, it makes little difference whether one emphasizes the disagreement that divides them in complicity or the complicity that unites them in disagreement. Now, to Cyprus and the specter of Europe, I say here this brief or not so brief commentary on power. I just thought that it may be important to sketch the theoretical context of discussing the 50 years of Cypriot independence from British colonial rule. Now, as I have already suggested, independence was not the first choice for Greek Cypriots. The anti-colonial struggle was fought in the name of union with Greece. Greek Cypriots wanted Cyprus to be part of Greece. It is also true that Cyprus is now a member of the European Union. It has arrived at its destination, so to speak. So how can I speak about the phantom or the specter of Europe? But I think that neither of these factors take anything away from the fact that 50 years down the road, 50 years of independence, in other words, Cyprus remains a post-colony. And by that, I mean a society formed during the colonial period, and hence a society that cannot not reproduce the colonial power that formed it. It cannot avoid doing that. And it seems to me that what has been ruling Cyprus during the last 50 years was not Cypriot themselves, but rather, through them, the idea of Europe or modernity, which, as I say, is a specter that accounts for the nationalist nightmares experienced in the country during its recent history. As I argued elsewhere, the Greek Cypriot desire to make Cyprus a Greek province rather than an independent country presupposes a set of fundamental Eurocentric assumptions. The first is the premise, which has been taken on board by all colonized societies that strove for independence, and that is the division of the world between the civilized and primitive societies, which was a 19th century division. The British used this extensively. That was the terminology that was used. Now we have a new lexicon, new terms which emerge because of the Americans after the Second World War, and that is the division between the modern and the traditional. And when we say traditional, we mean backward, basically. That's what it means. Now, this is also the premise taken on board by those peripheral societies such as Greece and Turkey, whose vision of the world has been colonized by the idea of Europe. Europe, even though they have never been colonies in the formal sense of the term, and I think what, when Michael Hertzfeld comes and gives his lecture, he may mention something like this. He calls them crypto-colonies because officially they were not colonies. Now the second premise, so it's about two premises that they were taken on board by Greek Cypriots. The second premise is the European claim that ancient Greece was the cradle of civilization, which is to say, according to this logic at any rate, post-Enlightenment European culture, the culture of democracy, rationality, science, and so on and so forth. I think the Germans were primarily responsible for inventing Greece as the cradle of civilization, and the British were enthusiastic about it as well. Now, this particular premise, gave modern Greek identity a unique advantage over all other dominant identities in the world, Arab, Oriental, African, Indian, and so on. The best any post-colony could ever hope for was to modernize and become like Europe, similar but never quite the same, as Baba says somewhere. By contrast, Greece, and to a lesser extent Cyprus, could claim to be part of Europe already, despite the fact that they were still lagging behind it. For historical and cultural reasons, they could claim that we are part of Europe. Although still modernizing, which in this case meant de-Ottomanizing, to modernize in Greece and Cyprus means to de-Ottomanize, because both countries were part of the Ottoman Empire. So although still modernizing, they had the right to claim European identity on account of being Greek. So I think it is in this context that Greek Cypriot desire to unite with Greece rather than become an independent country should be understood. Cyprus was in the margins of Europe. At worst, one could say Cyprus in the margins of Europe, it's a peripheral kind of a European country. At best, at worst, one could say that it is in the Middle East or the Levant. This is a term that the British used in the colonial times. The Levant means Lebanon and so on and so forth, which is not very positive for Greek Cypriots. They don't like it. Don't tell them that they come from the Middle East. They will kill you. So that was one thing. The second thing was that their Hellenistic credentials were often questioned by the British. The British said, well, how come you're Greeks? You look like Middle Eastern people. Okay, so you speak Greek, so big deal. I mean, you're not Greek. So that was very upsetting as well, I have to say. Well, not for me, but for Greek Cypriots. So independence was not the choice of Greek Cypriots. And when it came in 1960, it took a long time to find support. It was not until 1974 and the division of the island that the idea became more widely accepted. But even then, the implicit understanding was that Cyprus would be another Hellenic state and hence a society, as I've been arguing here, which could claim by right to be part of Europe or more broadly. It happens with my students all the time, sorry. Or more broadly, the West. The political realities notwithstanding, this compromise seems to have become partly possible, partly because Greek Cypriots had by this time come to see themselves as more modern and European than mainland Greeks because of a better functioning bureaucracy. These are the excuses or the, sort of the claims made, for example, and no doubt also because of the unprecedented affluence that was achieved by the late 1980s. In 2004, how are we doing with time? Am I just going very slowly? We are all right. In 2004, Cyprus was admitted to the European Union, and the fact was celebrated, of course, not surprisingly, with all the necessary fanfare. The decision to join the EU, it is often said by people in Cyprus, was guided by pragmatic considerations, political as well as economic. And I underline the word decision because the pragmatic people who argue in this way imply a voluntarism that has no basis in reality whatsoever. It was not a decision. To begin with, they imply that the European Union was ready to embrace Cyprus with open arms should it decide to join, which was not the case. They also imply that there was considerable skepticism in the country about the prospects of joining, in which case all the pros and cons would need to be debated and taken into consideration, or that a different historical alternative to being or claiming to be European which the EU membership formalized was ever seriously considered, so that a decision had to be made as to which way to go. Of course, there was no historical alternative, and I just want to say a few things about this last point. It is instructive to note that although Cyprus was one of the founding members of the non-aligned movement, it has never considered itself to be part of the Third World. On the contrary, being third worldly, the Greek term is tridogosmikos, is for Greek Cypriots synonymous to being backward. An index of the importance of the country's European credentials over whether whatever ties and affinities it maintained with the rest of the world is the fact that when it was asked to relinquish its non-aligned membership as a condition of joining the European Union, which I find an amazing thing, I don't know about you, but it had to stop being a member of the non-aligned movement in order to become a member of the European Union. Very interesting. No one in Cyprus seems to have considered this an issue of any sort. In fact, no one in government considered this an issue to be communicated to the wider public, and most people are ignorant of this fact to the present day. A friend of mine who found out accidentally during a training session on EU matters for civil servants, my friend was a civil servant and when Cyprus was going to become a member of the European Union, they had to be trained about Europe. So he found out about this thing and he was surprised. He asked the expert, the academic expert, why? Why the hell is this happening? Why? The academic expert training them had no answer and could not see the point in my friend's question. Why the hell are you asking me this question? There's no issue here. As far as he was concerned, it was a technical matter. The idea that it could have something to do with the incompatibility between a European and a third world identity does not seem to have crossed his mind at all. As far as the expert was concerned, okay, yeah, well, because, you know, we're going to join the European Union, we are a member of the non-aligned movement, so we have to stop being a member of the non-aligned movement in order to become a member of the European Union. Okay, so, big deal. No issue. I mean, there was no cultural issue as far as he was concerned. But anyway, to return to the scenarios just mentioned, none of them is remotely realistic. The idea that Cyprus was Greek and therefore historically and culturally European developed a long time ago and was to become widespread with the passage of time. It developed first among the educated elites, to be expected, and subsequently captured the imagination of the general population, which, as many commentators pointed out, eventually learn to think on the basis of ethnic and cultural rather than religious categories, not as Christians, but as Greeks. Some people still say Christians and Turks. They make it the older generation in Cyprus, you talk to them, they refer to themselves as Christians and to the Turkish Cypriots as Turks. They still don't say Greek. because they haven't learned it. You know, for them, the main identity is religion. Now, as for the readiness of the EU to accept Cyprus, it is indicative of the hurdles involved that when the country finally joined, the event was heralded by politicians both in Cyprus and in Greece as the greatest victory of Hellenism in the 20th century. Now, this is not to deny that there were also political and economic considerations involved in the so-called decision to join. The security, for example, that membership of the European Union would provide vis-à-vis Turkey. Rather, it is meant to highlight the wider cultural context in which such pragmatic considerations become relevant and meaningful. Now, the traumas of the Turkish invasion notwithstanding, one would be hard-pressed to deny that fear of Turkey is ultimately fear of Turkification, which is to say, fear of being taken over by the other. But I think the most glaring manifestation of how much the Greek Cypriot mind has been haunted by the specter of Europe is not the fact that the country is now a member of the European Union. Partly, it is how it deals with the European Union, and above all, I think, the fact that it is a dismembered member of the European Union. Now, to begin with, the dealings with the European Union, this is a classic example of symbolic domination or hegemony, which is to say, ruled by consent. With the single exception of the legislation on homosexuality and the introduction of civil marriage in Cyprus, both of which were fought by the church, there has been no other noticeable reaction to the EU directives. Unlike people in other member states, and I think Britain is a classic example here, Greek Cypriots do not feel that they are ruled by Brussels. What other people experience as an imposition that should be resisted, they experience as natural and necessary, a step towards full Europeanization. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the most effective way to legitimize new legislation is to let the public know that it is an EU requirement. Depending on the legislation, the public may not like it very much, but few people would doubt its necessity, and even fewer would be prepared to resist it. Certainly the church would resist some things, as I say, like the legislation for homosexuality and the civil marriage legislation. Now, to turn to the status of Cyprus as a dismembered European member, for the colonized mind that operates with a Eurocentric vision of the world, this was perhaps inevitable. Unlike most European societies for whom the problem until recently was to how to manage the other within, for Greek Cypriots, I beg your pardon, the problem with most of European societies was to manage the problem of the other without, not within. It is only recently that it became a problem to be managed within. Now, for Greek Cypriots, the problem has always been how to manage the other within. Now, when the issue was the union of Cyprus with Greece, the problem was how to prevent Turkish Cypriots and Turkey from preventing it. When the issue became the unification of Cyprus itself, the problem was how to prevent Turkish Cypriots and Turkish settlers from contaminating the purity that the image that the Greek Cypriots have about themselves. I'm just going to give you a recent example that I think illustrates this quite well. One of the proposals in the current round of negotiations have been going on since 1963 in Cyprus. The United Nations are fed up with us because we just can't solve this bloody problem. Anyway, this is the latest round of negotiations on the island. So one of the proposals was, you know, to unify the island was the rotation of the presidency between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. so many years a Greek Cypriot, so many years a Turkish Cypriot as a president. So a rotation. Now, many Greek Cypriots reject the idea as an abomination. So much so that in a local TV program, a well-known nationalist politician said that he was prepared to accept a Turkish settler as a vice president, provided that the president would always be Greek Cypriot. Now, at least the comment caused a stir, and in a qualifying statement, he complained that he was deliberately misrepresented. He did not want a settler to occupy any political office in Cyprus or in unified Cyprus because he did not want any settlers to remain in Cyprus after a solution to the problem. Now, as everyone knows, however, Turkish settlers, considered by Greek Cypriots to be even more other than Turkish Cypriots, will stay in Cyprus. The Greek Cypriot government announced that it was prepared to accept 50,000, only to withdraw his proposal recently under the pressure of the nationalist parties. Now, the choice for this man, for this nationalist politician, and of course for a lot of people, for a lot of other people who think like him, was therefore clear. If neither Turkish Cypriots nor the settlers can be excluded from the government in a unified Cyprus, it would be a lesser evil to have an other, a double other, in other words, a Turkish settler as a vice president, than to have an other, a Turkish Cypriot, in other words, as president. To his mind, the office of the president is a key symbol of the country and represents Cyprus to itself and, more importantly, to the outside world, while the office of the vice president has no such signifying power. I should have said that we have the presidential system in Cyprus, president, vice presidents like the United States. An arrangement of this sort would convey to all concerned the right message, namely that although the other is within, talking about Turkish Cypriots and Turks, the other takes second place and is under control. And this is the extent, I think, of the cultural contamination that the nationalist mind is prepared to tolerate. Failing that, total exclusion of Turkish Cypriots would be preferable. Cyprus would remain divided, but the part that counts for Greek Cypriots, of course, would at least be purely Greek and European, which, as opinion polls suggest, seems to be what the majority of Greek Cypriots want if their ideal solution cannot be implemented. Now, I said a lot of things about Greek Cypriots, I'm one of them myself, but I have things to say about Turkish Cypriots as well. Turkish Cypriots, I think, suffer from the same affliction, perhaps more so than Greek Cypriots, since for them the other that they have to deal with is themselves. And I'm just going to give you a few examples to illustrate this point. I have already suggested that for Greek Cypriots and mainland Greeks, modernization or Europeanization inevitably meant de-Ottomanization. Such, however, was also the aim of the founder of modern Turkey and the father of the Turks, Mustafa Kemal, whose vision of Turkishness was warmly embraced by Turkish Cypriots and is diligently upheld today, despite the pressures exerted on them by the rise of Islamism in Turkey. I have also suggested that for Greek Cypriots, the Turkish settlers in northern Cyprus epitomize otherness. But such is also the way that many Turkish Cypriots view them, particularly people from Anatolia, as an other that spoils the European image they have about themselves. I have argued that for Greek Cypriots, joining the European Union formalized a claim that they have always made about themselves, namely that they are modern European people. But such is also the claim that Turkish Cypriots and mainland Turks make about themselves and the way in which they strive to legitimize this claim. As is well known, the Turkish bid to join the European Union is driven by this claim and finds support in many EU member states. As for the Turkish Cypriots themselves, it is now widely recognized that the catalyst for voting overwhelmingly in favor of the United Nations peace plan for Cyprus in 2004, which, as I say, the Greek Cypriots rejected, the Turkish Cypriots overwhelmingly accepted. Now, it is now recognized that the reason, the catalyst, was the prospect of becoming formally European, since Cyprus was to become an EU member state in the following month. Now, these are well-known historical events, and they are on public record, but there are countless of other examples of the Turkish Cypriot infatuation with the modern and the European, that being ordinary events and everyday events, do not make the headlines. I think that they are as important as the historical events. I'm just going to mention only one example of an ordinary everyday event, partly because I was puzzled by this event to begin with, and partly because it reminded me of a popular ethnography about village life in Egypt, written by an Indian anthropologist and novelist whose work I admire. Now, during the summer of 2003, when many Turkish Cypriots rebelled against the regime in the north and rallied in favor of the United Nations peace plan, I met several people with whom I became friends. One of the things that struck me in our conversations was their claim that, unlike Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots were deeply religious. This, my Turkish Cypriot friends said, was one of the major differences between the two communities. Turkish Cypriots are secular, Greek Cypriots are deeply religious. That was the claim. I found the comment puzzling, and because it was repeated several times, annoying as well. I was annoyed with it. I was puzzled, but I was also annoyed. What if Greek Cypriots were religious? Than more religious than Turkish Cypriots, I thought to myself. Religion has not been an issue in the conflict between the two communities. Ethnicity has been the issue, not religion. It then occurred to me that perhaps this claim was not related to the prospects of unification, which was the main topic of our conversations and the issue on most people's mind at the time. Perhaps my Turkish Cypriot friends were trying to tell me something else. As is well known, secularism is supposed to be one of the hallmarks of modernity, since it is inextricably associated with rationalism, the triumph of knowledge over ignorance and superstition, the disenchantment of the world, as Max Weber once said, and so on and so forth. So it looks like, and of course I can never be certain about this, but it seems that what my Turkish friends were wanted to say was that, contrary to what Greek Cypriots thought about them, they were modern European people, more so, in fact, than Greek Cypriots, who still clung to religion. Now, this interpretation, I think, also explains the fact that I was annoyed. Deep down, I was caught in the game of playing modern and European myself. Not easy to get over this, believe me. This ordinary event reminded me of an incident that Amitav Ghosh describes in his ethnography of village life in Egypt, a quarrel with a local imam for whom the Indian practice of burning the dead and worshipping cows was primitive. Having argued with him bitterly as to whose country was more modern and civilized, India or Egypt, Ghosh reflects in the following way, and this is a quotation. "At that moment," he says, "despite the vast gap that lay between us, we understood each other perfectly. We were both traveling, he and I. We were traveling in the West," end of quote. "So too," I thought, "was I and my friends, Greeks and Turkish Cypriots in general. We have been traveling in Europe all these years of independence, in quotation marks, towards the same phantom destination, but apart. And because of this, we have never managed to live together on this island. And to conclude, because the foregoing may suggest what I've said, in other words, may suggest that I'm envisioning a possibility of a decolonized Cypriot mind and perhaps also a future in which Greek and Turkish Cypriots will live in perfect harmony. The left in Cyprus says, we are like brothers, we are brothers. It's a lot of, I'm not going to use that term. In any case, perfect harmony. We are going to live in perfect harmony, some people say. So I would like to close this paper with a few qualifications. Firstly, it is certainly the case that autonomy is one of the most fundamental premises of European culture. It is a definition of what it means to be a subject, whether an individual or collective subject, a person, in other words, a society, a nation, and so on and so forth. It should suffice to point out that this premise of autonomy is enshrined in the motto of the Enlightenment. Think for yourself. I've already mentioned this. It constitutes the basis of the institution where European thought reaches its highest summit, namely the university, and it circulates widely in everyday life and ordinary discourse. As I have suggested at the beginning of this paper, it is also the case that at this historical conjuncture, European thought is beginning to recognize, which is not to say accept necessarily, that achieving autonomy through independent reflection is not possible. For no one can think from nothing. Even the most reflexive subject, for example, the kind of subject that Giddens and Beck have in mind, so reflexive. Whole reflexivity, Giddens is telling us. So even the most reflexive subject must take something for granted in order to think at all. And of course, the limiting case here is the Enlightenment directive to think for oneself. Even if this was the only thing that one would have to accept without questioning, one would still be dependent on someone else, on the guardians, as Kant said in the famous essay on what is on the question of what is enlightenment. So one has to be dependent on the guardians. In this particular case, one has to be dependent on Kant himself as the guardian. So thinking about it in this way, we can think about this also more sociologically, I think, the fact, in other words, that we have to take things for granted, that one inevitably is dependent on one's society and culture for ideas to think with. Now, with this recognition, whether it is considered as the final word on the matter or not, it seems to me that European culture comes full circle from pre-liberatory times when the subject was supposedly not yet thinking for itself and was therefore subject to the powers that be, to post-liberatory times when thinking for oneself leads to the realization that one cannot think for oneself and that therefore the subject is beyond liberation. But with this, we come full circle as well, and by we I mean post-colonial subjects, at least those of us who have been following Europe closely in this journey that leads back to the point of departure, which is to say nowhere. Whether we like it or not, we are forced to admit that autonomy is a figment of the European imagination which the most credulous among us, again, I mean the post-colonial subjects, took for a real thing. So I do not think that minds can be decolonized, nor do I think that post-colonial societies like Cyprus can exorcise the specter of Europe. But perhaps this realization is not as pessimistic as it may appear at first sight. My colleagues accuse me of pessimism all the time. We may not be able to put specters at rest, chase the shadows away, and construct a world suffused with light, but perhaps we can learn to live with them, become so familiar that if nothing else, they no longer cause the kind of nationalist nightmares that Cyprus or Cypriots know only too well. At a time when the two communities are considering yet again whether it would be possible to live together on the island instead of traveling apart in Europe, this thought, I think, may prove of critical importance or some importance. Thank you. Thank you.